Welcome to the Technology Labs podcast, number 15, if I'm correct.
Yes.
And I'm Tom.
I'm Rick.
And I'm Daniel.
And our guest today is Dee. Welcome, Dee, in our midst.
Hi.
Hi there. Hi, nice to have you. Would you be so kind to introduce yourself in a couple of sentences to the audience?
Hello, Tom. First of all, thank you for having me here, Tom, this evening. I'm Dee Dionne with Lepcha. I'm working as a delivery manager for digital manufacturing, DMF division.
Mm-hmm. Good.
Yes, and I've been working with Sogeti and Capgemini for 9 years now.
Nice. Good. Well, you are a subject matter expert, I know, on technical publications, right? And, well, that is at least one of the topics that we're going to discuss in this podcast today. So later on, we'll delve deeper into the topic of technical publications and see what the great technicalities and cool solutions we have out there and what we build and what we do. But before we go there, we have a couple of tech updates to share and to talk about. So feel free to join in and talk with us on these tech topics. And actually, I wanted to... I'll start myself for once. I have a nice tech topic with me, and that is Spot. You all know Spot, right?
Spot?
Spot the dog.
Oh, that one, yeah.
Yeah. The Boston Dynamics robot dog. It's called Spot.
Oh, it's called Spot. Oh, I didn't know that.
The nice little yellow robot dog, indeed. And Spot has an arm. And you might think, why is that? Why does Spot have an arm?
I have seen Spot with a very long neck.
Yeah.
Is that the same thing as the arm?
Yes, it's familiar. You could also say a beak. And it's in terms of a dog, it has a head and a beak, something with a very long, very long neck, indeed.
Sort of a dog with a swan's neck.
Yeah, that's a good description.
Okay, then I know it.
For the hefty price of $74,500, you are the proud owner of Spot the dog with its robotic arm. So, you ordered one yet, Rick? I know you're a fan of these robotic things.
Well, I'll definitely discuss it over dinner tonight with my wife.
Okay.
Is that 74,000 only? Okay. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
Should not be a problem.
It's for the whole dog, right? Not only the arm, right?
No, it's a dog. So it's dog and arm. Dog with arm. Yeah. Exactly.
No, but actually, it's not very expensive for industrial possibilities.
Yeah, exactly, because the dog can work in hazardous work sites like nuclear plants or offshore oil fields, that kind of things, and go to remote places or places where we as humans don't want to be. And with its robotic arm, it can actually perform all kinds of activities, repairs and stuff like that. Spot the dog.
Yeah, I was with an arm. Also thinking a very nice possibility would be for helping rescue teams, example, it's now winter with skiing, so maybe if there is an avalanche, you just send the robot dog, and in the bad occasion that the robot dog gets in the avalanche, well, you just wait for it for the snow to melt, and you have your robot dog back.
Yep.
And in the meantime, it can move, because that's the best thing of it, that it can go in terrains where normally vehicles don't come.
Yeah. And that's true, indeed. It can go into places, snow-covered situations where it's very difficult to travel. But the cool thing, it's controlled with a supervised autonomy system using a tablet. It has a part autonomous, part supervised system where you as a driver, or how would you call it? Steering of Spot the dog, you can control it for a part, so for delicate maneuvers or for repairs. A repairman can now work from home and control Spot the dog, send Spot the dog in, and work from home with its manuals on one screen and the video screen of Spot the dog next to it, and then maybe an AR layer on it, and it can perform all kinds of activities and all kinds of mechanical labor or repairs or all that kind of stuff. So it's probably a nice tie-in with technical publications, right, Dee? The TechPub together with Spot the Dog, we can create cool opportunities for remote repairing, right?
Yes, that would be great, Tom. Yeah, the AR VR functionality.
Yeah. So we don't need the AR VR on ourselves, but we can project stuff through Spot the Dog on screen, where the operator sits and can do his job, his or her job, right? Cool. And I believe also, maybe that's also good for discussing over dinner, Rick. You can add a what is it? An extra charger. So it has extra batteries, I think, and that costs no, the robotic arm is used also for charging, so it can, when it's sensing that its batteries are empty, it will walk back to the charging station and it will charge again. And if you want an extra charging station, might be handy, it only costs you $38,950.
Oh. So half of the price is the charging station.
You'll get one with it, right?
About it, I was thinking that in his robot mouth, it just would have a power plug. So while it walks by a
socket
power outlet, it just
plugs in.
So then you see this dog sort of licking the power supply.
Oh, I'm a bit mistaken. The 38,000 was for the thermal camera. I just misread it.
Okay.
And the extra charging station only costs, €2,000 or something like that.
Oh,
so.
Okay.
That makes sense.
that makes sense. Dee is already ordering one. I see her clicking on the ordering website right now.
Do you have any information, Tom, about what kind of companies already bought the dog? Or is it so short for sale that nobody bought it yet?
That's a good question. And I'm looking through the article, which we will share, of course, in the show notes.
While you are looking, because I recently saw a video of the fire department using drones to get an overview of a fire. Where's the fire? But they also could use such a robot dog to do the real hazardous saving during a fire.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So before you know it, the firemen are only operating all kinds of machines, and they don't have to go in the building themselves anymore.
Yeah, just as the bomb squads, and nowadays bomb squads also.
These little robots for bomb diffusion.
Yeah. I can imagine that it's much cheaper to send in a Spot or a robot for. Instead of a human to do this work, right? Even if it costs, you blow up $100,000 robot.
Yeah, and the big difference, of course, is these bomb squads, they currently use robots that are on caterpillar tracks.
Okay.
So they can run on reasonably rough terrain, but they cannot walk through a forest or something like that. And that's what a robot dog can do.
Yeah.
So it brings new opportunities.
True.
And also, I think we could enjoy ourselves very much in playing a game of dog football. Just put 11 of these dogs in a field and see who wins.
Might be interesting.
I see Daniel looking like, let's go to the next tech item.
Maybe that's a good thing. Yeah, let's go to the next tech item. Daniel, what is your tech item for today?
Yes, it's not about dogs, but it's about Twitter, because Twitter just bought a Dutch company called Revue.
Oh, yeah, I've heard about that.
Revue is a service that helps people publish newsletters. And a lot of people probably think newsletters, that's not that tech or new tech, it's kind of old stuff. But there's a lot of companies actually using Revue for publishing their newsletters, both free and also paid newsletters.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a service where you had to pay, like, I think $30 or something per month if you had more than X thousand subscribers, for instance. So you had to pay more if you had more subscribers.
Okay.
But now it's part of Twitter, and Twitter actually made it free for everybody. So if you want to create your own newsletter and you want to publish that through Twitter, for instance, you can use Review to publish your newsletter. And then, of course, also the integrations will appear with Twitter, because currently that's not really a thing yet. But it will probably be really easy to pull in a tweet from Twitter and then add that to your newsletter, for instance. But it's a really nice tool. I have been using it for a newsletter as well, and I was surprised how easy it worked. And it's also really nice with the archive, etc. And you can also send it through email. How very modern of me, but you can also send it through an email to everybody who's your subscriber, of course. But there's still lots of people subscribing to newsletters because they would love to have a weekly newsletter about tech, for instance, or about a certain subject. And yeah, that's where Review actually did a lot of work on. And it's interesting that they got bought by Twitter, because yeah, newsletters, I don't think it's really something new, but it still has its use after all those years. And but, that's pretty interesting, I believe.
And now the million-dollar question. Can it be used to add punch card tech in newsletters?
I don't know. I don't have any knowledge about that. Maybe Rick knows how that works.
Maybe we can convert punch card data into readable data for newsletter technology that's then being delivered to Twitter. And then we have an interface between punch cards and Twitter.
Yeah, but that's saying the same thing as making an interface between USB sticks and Twitter. Because punch cards are just the carrier of data. Eh? So of it doesn't matter whether you use a punch card or a USB stick.
Okay, yeah.
The only difference is that you could actually print your whole newsletter on a punch card. I think some of you are now looking like, what are they talking about? But hey, this is what a punch card looked like. Eh?
I
recently found one while I was cleaning a little bit up, and then I use it in my book to indicate where I am in reading. So,
but for the podcast listeners, because we can see it and Dee can see it, and
podcast, I have to describe.
You have to describe it. Yeah.
At first, it is cardboard. It is the size is about 15 to 18 centimeters wide. And about 6 high, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
And
okay.
It has 80 columns. That is very characteristic of a punch card. So you can put 80 characters on one punch card.
Okay.
That's also the reason why old-fashioned computer monitors had 80 columns, because one punch card need to be on the screen.
Really?
Yeah.
Hey.
Wow.
Well, thanks for the history lesson.
Yeah. Now we've learned something today.
That's pretty old.
Whoa.
What do you say?
That's pretty old, right?
It is. Oh, yeah, but I recently celebrated my 30th anniversary in IT. So, and I must admit, when I joined IT, punch cards were already almost outdated. So I only used punch card in the first couple of years. And
but this is a nice lesson. I did not know the 80 columns correspond to the 80 columns in the old screens of back then.
Yeah.
That's really cool. That's some cool knowledge. Yeah.
Yeah. Maybe it's good to ask Rick to do a webinar or something about punch cards.
Yeah. Maybe we can create an episode about punch cards and invite all kinds of guests who know also stuff about punch cards.
Yeah. Very technology leader kind of thing, right?
I actually was thinking saving that for the month before I retire or something like that. That's a nice that's the last podcast that we are recording before my retirement. We'll do this, okay?
Yeah.
But that will, depending on the government, will take another decade or so. So
and I don't expect you to, even if you retire from working for a company for our company, then you will still continue with technology and stuff like that, right?
Yeah, probably. I'll just continue with the podcast. I have much more time for it then. Well, okay. Let's move on, I would say.
Yes, Rick.
Congratulations, Rick, for the 30 years.
Yeah.
Well, thank you. Yeah.
When was it?
I started in 1980.
Nice.
So on the 1st of September. No, September. 1st of September.
Okay.
Yeah.
Nice anniversary.
Wow. Cool.
What is your tech item, Rick, while we're at it?
Oh, well, actually, my tech item has a little bit to do with history, although it's mostly about future. But a colleague of us in Society Labs, he posted a blog, and the title of the blog is, "Was Sir Thomas Watson Right All Along?" Uh-huh. And then most people will just wonder, who was right all along? But I instantly remembered who Sir Thomas Watson was, because Sir Thomas Watson was one of the famous chairmen of IBM, the big computer company.
Yeah.
And a famous saying of this same Sir Thomas Watson, and remember, the chief executive of IBM, the big computer company, and he said, and I must admit, it was in 1943, he said, "Well, for the whole world, I think we need about 5 computers." So how wrong can you be?
Wow.
Only in the room where I'm sitting now, there are already 5 computers.
Incredible.
So, but the analogy in the article of our colleague Julian Velse is that he now is looking into quantum computing.
Ah.
And quantum computing has been a promise for a long time already, but now companies are building the first quantum computers. Mm-hmm. But there's a little bit of a problem with these quantum computers, and that is they need to be cooled to almost the absolute zero. So that's like 273 below zero or something like that.
273.15, yes. Yeah.
Okay, well, that's good that we have that kind of high-tech people amongst us. So to be able to have a machine at that low temperature, the biggest problem is the whole cooling system, and it's going to be a huge box and it's going to be quite difficult. So now people are thinking, if these machines are so complex and we need all this technology, maybe we will only build about 5 of them for the whole world. And that's, of course, a nice analogy, nice touch, because with the technology of today, we think that more than 5 of them won't be feasible. But if you look at the gigantic leap we made in normal computing since 1943, which, of course, is now like 75 years ago, even more. So in 75 years from now, it may be that every handheld smartphone is a quantum computer, and they solve the cooling problem in one way or the other. or the handheld smartphones are very heavy.
Wow. You have to carry.
So that was what struck me. But. Yeah. Now, you guys know much more about modern technology than I do. At least that's what you always pretend. So I still, after reading the article, don't get what actually is the difference between a quantum computer and a normal computer.
Well, the quantum computer can work in parallel with a huge amount of variables. And a regular computer can only use a simple set of variables and calculate through it. So if it needs to go to multiple dimension, it needs to calculate it sequentially, all those dimensions. So you do first the one dimension, do all the calculations on that one dimension, then do the second one, etc., etc. And a quantum computer can do the same thing, but only in parallel. So the total calculation time is heavily shortened, is exponentially shortened, actually. So where we now have sometimes we have problems where we say, okay, we have a machine with 1,000 variables, and to calculate all the to look at all the situations of all the variables, only if they have two or three values yeah, for all those variables. It will take us the lifetime of the universe until now to calculate it through, if every calculation takes a millisecond or something like that. And with quantum computing, all of a sudden, it is reduced to hours. More hours. Okay. So that's a huge difference between regular computing and quantum computing. But the first... The first quantum computers are not that... They only have a limited set of those variables. So they can only go... They are improving the calculation only a little bit. So where we are at hundreds of years right now, they can go to hours. But where we have calculations that would take us now thousands of years, it will take that quantum computer still a huge amount of time. So But if you increase the amount of variables for quantum computing, then yeah, a lot more comes within reach for us. So it's probably a lot uses in simulation and in doing predictions in the near future. I can imagine at least.
So for quantum computing, I think that it's probably not needed to have a whole lot of quantum computers, right? It's for really specific cases.
That's what this guy said for 77 years ago also, yeah. Right? And look at us now.
Yeah. Well, we'll see. Maybe in 70 years we'll stand incorrected.
By the time that Daniel retires as well, you can do a podcast about quantum computing.
Huh? Quantum computing, cool. Now, well, let's go from quantum computing to the Borgfield where D is operating. And actually, a nice, also tech-related item that we did in a Dutch podcast only recently, that was about the use of VR and AR Apple glasses that are now announced by Apple. And I believe the VR glasses were announced for 2022, Rick, and the AR glasses 2023, right?
Yeah, that's correct.
Augmented reality, but also virtual reality, is something that plays a role in the things you do as well, right, Dee?
Yes.
So can you explain to us what this technical publication is all about and give a couple of examples maybe to us?
Sure, of course. Technical publications mainly, we call it a technical publication suite. So we have engineers who are working on technical documentations. Mm-hmm. So the technical documentations are the manuals or procedures that you see if you buy a technical, buy a cell phone, for example. Mm-hmm. It comes with the manual, technical descriptions. So those are like the technical documentations. But we also have different machines where you need to install. So all those documentation is what we write as technical authors. Okay. And also the other part of technical documentation, technical publications is illustrations. So you can see those beautiful pictures in those manuals and documentation. So those are all drawn by the technical authors. We also call them illustrators. And then the main part is publishing. So those content, normally we do it digitally. So those are later published to a digital platform or a PDF or paper. So that's complete technical publication suite. So that's what we do. And as you mentioned, AR, VR, augmented reality and virtual reality. Now we are making it easy for the technicians and field service engineers. So they do not have to take the manuals, the paper content or digital content. So they can just use the lenses, HoloLenses. Now you mentioned Apple. Mm-hmm. So they can just use the, lenses to see their whole machine. You can with the instructions installing a machine or the installing, for example. So that's where the augmented reality and virtual reality comes into picture.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Cool. And yeah, I can imagine that indeed with augmented reality, all of a sudden, the need for education of those service engineers. Usually, the service engineers need a lot of education on the variety of technical or the variety of products that are out there. If there's let's take a digging machine, and you could service a digging machine, right? It has a lot of mechanical parts that could need replacement because of wear and tear. And then you need to go there and take it apart and replace a certain part and then put it all back and make it work again. And I can imagine that the variety of digging machines that those engineers should know, the service engineers should know all about, because one machine with version X is different than version Y, and version Y.1 and Y.2 we are really different than version Y, etc., etc. So this exponentially helps all those service engineers to do their job and not to having to learn everything by heart or indeed look up in all the manuals on what to do. So it speeds up all of this a lot. I can also imagine that there's you said publications, the platforms, manuals. So are we using a lot of manuals nowadays? We as consumers, for example, you said there's a manual with a mobile phone, and Daniel is nodding no.
I don't do that.
So I can imagine that manuals are made, but they are mandatory because of rules and regulations. How does that go? Because a lot of manuals do not get used by us. My new mobile phone, it comes out of the box and there's probably a manual in there, but I don't think I've looked at it or opened it. But it is in there.
Yeah, that was more an example just to give you an idea of the technical documentation. But those manuals are mainly used in the factory.
Okay, okay.
We also have customers like ASML who has a very big machine, the EUV and the DUV systems. Mm-hmm. And to construct those, you really need those manuals, and that's really vastly used.
Okay.
And so that those are the areas that we use. And of course, if your car breaks down, you do not start reading the manuals, but you go to the service engineers, for example. So they also have those manuals, but with experience, of course. So those are the uses of the manuals still, Tom.
Okay. And now I'm also curious about VR, because AR, I can understand. There's a service engineer. He's at the plant installing a big machine with glasses on, and he gets projected and he sees, oh, this bolt goes there, and I have to turn this, and pointers and everything. Where's VR used in this in technical publication? Virtual reality, how is that used? Do you have an example of that? Because I can imagine that it might be used more for training purposes, because VR, we discussed it, Rick and I discussed it just now. VR glasses from Apple, they are first coming with the VR glasses. They are going over your eyes as glasses, but you cannot see the outside world with VR. You can only see the two screens in front of your eyes, right? So interaction with a system is then more difficult. So it's probably more on the educational part, for example, that you get these VR experiences. Is that also done on training, for training purposes, for example?
Yes. That's mostly also used in the training purposes. Because of COVID, a lot of companies, they used to have classroom trainings. And that's not possible anymore. So that's where the VR part comes in, also to train the technicians or the service engineers to how to install, or how more information about the product that they're going to work on. Mm-hmm. So that's also the interesting field.
Yeah. Oh, that's an interesting one. Yeah.
Yeah, and Dee, you are involved in this now for some time, but can you give us an idea how rapidly this field is growing?
Yes, I think more and more companies, they are going to the future. So they want to be the number one in the digital transformation as well. Mm-hmm. So I think there has been quite a request from the customers that they want to use AR and VR. So they are still, we have a team in France and also in India who is really working in this field, and they have also proven experiences for some of the customers.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you mentioned our colleagues in France. Are these also colleagues who are involved with the aviation industry, where they work on repairing and building aircraft, etc.?
I'm not sure about that, Rick, but I work with a team who work with, I think they did a project for, no, I don't remember at the moment.
Okay, it doesn't matter much, but I once saw an example when I was with our colleagues in France, where they were starting to use it.
So did they use it as a remote assist kind of scenario, Rick, or...?
No, it was actual augmented reality, and it was a couple of years ago when the Google Glass just came out.
Oh, yeah.
And then using the Google Glass to instruct the repairman where to put parts, etc., and how to take the machine apart and build it together again.
So that's kind of remote assist, right?
Well, I don't know exactly what you mean with remote assist. Because
assist.
Yeah, remote so assist.
Yeah, so somebody
remote thing.
Remote is somebody else who can, for instance, help them out on how to give them instructions on how to do something.
The idea was that actually the manual was projected on the Google Glass. In real time, in overlay.
Okay. Yeah.
But I can also imagine that indeed in the remote assistance is that you have just a camera, even a camera on your head is enough, eh? You don't need a Google Glass for it. but a camera on your head can also act as the transmitter to the experts. Maybe you have a couple of companies maybe have five experts within their midst that know everything about all the machines, but they have more service engineers. And then accessing the or unlocking all the situations for those five experts remotely, that can be a huge benefit for those companies. Yeah, it can save a lot of time, and you're directly training those other people again.
I see a lot of remote assist scenarios with VR, AR kind of thing, or at least AR. And there's of course the elevator engineer that I already talked about in an earlier one. But those kinds of scenarios are of course really interesting, because then those five people that you talked about, Tom, don't have to travel. Don't have to. Yeah, that's the big thing, of course. I believe that it's a really cool area to work in, at least.
Exactly. Yeah. That's true. Go ahead, Rick.
I'm curious. What is the typical demand of a client when they first get in touch with you?
So normally, a lot of customers, a lot of engineers are writing the documentations, and that's not one of their one of the things that the engineers want to do. Yes, and also I think one of the challenges they have is on the quality, because our technical documentation authors are also trained to write in simplified technical English, so customers can have engineers from different countries, so not all the languages are written in a simplified form. So our technical engineers they write the documentation that is understood by all the field engineers and service engineers around the globe. So those are, I think, a few of the examples that they come us for a request, and where we help them.
And then the funny thing I wonder is if the people that are writing these technical publications, they mainly must be good writers, I guess, but they need to understand technology, otherwise they don't know what they're writing about. But I guess writing is more important than technology for them, isn't it?
Not completely true, no? Right? Okay. Writing is as much as important, but that's the added value of our team, because all those technical authors are from the engineering background. And that really helps them understand the end-to-end of the machines. And they are not only writing the documentations, but also giving feedback to the customers if they find something or can interact easily with the engineers. So that really helps in in working time and in the quality delivery as well.
Oh, so you're saying that they're actually testing while writing technical documentation, you are testing for the you're bringing the quality level of the product even to a higher level.
Yes.
Oh, that's really cool. Yeah.
So that's an interesting perspective on reviewing.
That was
reviewing just by writing the manual. That's a good thing.
Yeah, but sometimes even if writing a manual or writing the technical drawings, like the illustrators, mm-hmm. like Dee mentioned, I can imagine if you draw the picture, if you create the drawing, those great exploded views and stuff like that, that's where you see when stuff designed by different departments comes together, would fit or not, even without real physical things. So that's... Yeah, it's an awesome way of measuring quality, or measuring quality, not measuring, but determining the quality or finding faults early.
Yeah.
That's cool.
Yeah, that's awesome how this technology can, how it works out in the quality field as well.
It's a new marketing strategy.
Improving quality by technical publications.
Yes, and also I think the technical documentations, we go for first time right.
Mm-hmm.
So, because also mainly our experience lies also in the aerospace, they really want quality the first time right, and it's about 95%.
Okay, that's quite high because I think a lot of software projects would be very happy if they get 95% right.
True.
So, well, if you can manage that with technical writing, I think that's a very high percentage.
Indeed.
Yeah, yeah, really also cool. Developers would love to have a technical writer on their team.
I can imagine. Yeah.
Well, the interesting thing, Daniel, is actually that we think it is odd to have a technical writer on the team, because today not many teams do have it. But and then I agree, I have to go back to almost 40 years ago again. But back then, in our teams, we actually did have technical writers, or mainly technical drawers, because back then, of course, drawing the designs of software architecture had to be drawn by hand, because we didn't have graphical computers yet.
Mm-hmm.
So we actually had people who made drawings in huge pieces of paper, and then every time we made a design change, we heard them, made funny noises, because they had to make the whole painting and drawing all over again. but back then it was normal to have this kind of people on a team. So maybe we'll see that coming back again, because I see many things coming back again. So.
Right. I think we still have that technical authors in the team nowadays as well. So that's where we have software technical publications. So there are also some of my team members, they are doing software publications, and that's where they write the release notes or software.
Of course.
We do it for companies like Dell as well. So we checked we are also part of the Scrum teams. So part of the Jira, where we take all the defects, check, and then we write the documentation for them.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so actually it was not a strange idea, Daniel.
No, I know, because if I look at some of the teams I have been working in before, writing code or writing documentation is two completely different things. And I know a lot of great programmers that don't like to write documentation on it. So it makes sense.
Yeah, but then I wonder, do you need very different people for this, or are they just a little bit different? Because like Daniel says, most tech guys don't like to document.
Mm-hmm. Yes, we have different people for different kind of documentation, Rick. So for the technical documentations, we normally look for electrical engineers, mechanical engineers. And for the software publications, they come from an IT or a computer background so that they can understand the system better. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And not only on the technical part, we also get requests for some white paper publishing. So, of course, the content comes from the customers, but we develop the documents for them.
Cool. Are there any specific rules and regulations that require specific technical publication activities that we do, Dee? Because I know that there's a lot in that area to do as well, right?
Yes. So there are lots of standards that our technical authors follow. So for aerospace, there are ATA 100 standards. I think semiconductor other industries, we have the 1000D DITA. So all the standards also we follow for technical publications. And it's not only documentation. The safety review part is really important. Mm-hmm. So there is a team of separate safety reviewers who does the safety reviewing of the document as well.
Okay.
So can you explain to me what is a safety review of a document? Because the document itself is quite safe, I would say.
You don't forget paper cuts, huh?
Yeah, of course.
Now, the safety review is also when you are handling a machine that, you know, the warnings, like, okay, you know, you have to
all this kind of watch things. Out, this can be hot or this can hurt you or whatever. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. I see you thinking.
Well, I'm thinking back of machines that I've seen that I once saw a machine for cutting paper, but then in a huge form, and it had two buttons, and you had to press the buttons like this. Oh, and for the listeners, I'm now holding my arms very far apart.
Yeah.
So you can never push both buttons without having both arms on the buttons. Mm-hmm. So you will never have your arm in the machine. But probably still the manual would need to have a warning. Don't put your arm in.
Similarly, Rick.
Yeah. But that's interesting that you have that kind of specific. And are there also other aspects that they then need to look for? Because safety is one important thing, but you could think of like environmentally friendly stuff or whatever.
Not that I know of, Rick, but for chemical customers who are working with chemical substances, they also have some compliances to follow, like REACH and all. So that's also where we help and support the customers to be compliant on those aspects.
Yeah. And then the typical kind of customers for this would be all kinds of engineering companies who have, I guess, a combination of IT and OT. Is that correct, or is it also IT only?
Both, I think, right, Tom?
Yeah.
A combination of IT and OT, Rick.
Yeah. You see, of course, I think you see the technical publications are associated more with OT upfront. But as Dee already mentioned, we do it for software engineering as well. And then you can imagine that it's in the office automation or in for banking, insurance. It doesn't really matter anymore what kind of industry it's being done, right? And whether it's IT or OT. Yeah. On that note, IT, OT, looking at the time, we are nearing the end mark of this session already. And I think it's really cool to see that indeed technical publications are so widely spread already and can contribute to quality. A lot of cool technology is entering the world of technical documentations with AR and VR, and who knows what else, with Spot the Dog, where we started with. Who knows that the Spot the Dog might enter then.
Indeed, I never realized before that the combination of technical publications and AR and VR, that's one of the, I probably would say, killer apps.
Uh-huh.
Because when we were talking about these virtual reality glasses, we were wondering what actually would be a use case. But this definitely is a use case that companies are willing to pay the price for.
Sure, sure.
Yep. And also not to follow, it's not only in English that we write the technical documentations, but also different languages, Rick.
Oh, yeah. Oh, okay. And what other languages are asked about by clients?
I think we support about 36 languages.
Wow.
We do 36? Translations. Yeah. We have translations in Dutch, Spanish, also Chinese.
French, probably.
Yeah.
Oh, but then very important is, especially in this winter time, do you also have it in Fries? Because we need to have the instructions to repair our skates, of course.
I think it's time to cut Rick off now.
Oh, yeah.
Exactly. Exactly. Then later on, he's coming with the Hague or in all kinds of dialogue, dialects.
Yeah, but I guess having more than 30 languages already is far more than I had expected. Yeah. Which is indeed a great thing.
Yeah, it's cool that it's so widely spread in all those different languages as well. So it's really cool to see. Yeah. Thank you, Dee, for your time in this podcast.
Yeah. Thanks a lot.
Talking us through technical publications. Thank you, audience, for listening.
Much.
And I would say see you soon in our next podcast.
Yeah. Bye-bye.
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 Thank you.